All right. You ready to go?
As far as I'm going to. Yeah.
That's a better answer. What's up? This is Movies On Up. Respect the throne. As always, I show respect to my podcast co-host, Mr. Dave Becella.
Bow to me!
That's Mr. Dave. I am Ryan. We are Movies On Up. Respect the throne is our tagline for this week. If you think you know what movie that comes from, you can send your guest to us in one of the following ways. You can email us, moviesonup@gmail.com. You can put your guest on our Facebook page, which is going to be much more active this year. I've just
we
now
say
said
that every
it,
year.
So, yeah, but I mean it this time.
this year. Twitter and Facebook more active.
Gonna blow up. So literally, we could have one or two posts.
We've promised it. We even had a social media person for a year.
Fired her.
Yeah.
The Facebook page is facebook.com/moviesonup, or you can tweet your guests to us @moviesonup on the Twitter. If you are correct and we choose you, we will deliver to you a king's ransom, which is the Movies On Up prize package. If you can tell us where Respect the Throne came from. This week, the second episode of 2019, is our favorite movies from 2018. We try and put it off as long as we can to see more movies, and I was watching some last night, one of which did make the list. It's going to get to a point where we're going to be doing this episode in like June. It's going to replace our halftime list. We're just going to do our best.
Our halftime show. Maybe we should just add that.
Combine them.
The halftime show this year, maybe it'll be what we didn't see by the end of 2018. Also.
Oh, that's too hard. That's too hard. I'm willing to wait until June and do, here's all the best movies from last year, 6 months in. Oh, and here's ones that I've liked from this year.
I want to preface.
Preface away.
I feel like this year I was the most comfortable because I finally accepted it. These are our favorite movies, and I think we say that on every episode. They're not the best Scorsese movies. We try to preface everything and say it's our favorite movies. So these are my favorite movies of the year, because sometimes, you know, I put myself and it's like, oh, well, that movie was so good. It's hard to make a top 10 list without it.
Right.
Like the year 12 Years a Slave. Was that one of the best movies I saw that year? Absolutely. Was it one of my favorite 10? No,
I don't recall.
I don't want to rewatch it.
Sure. Like, but rewatchability doesn't necessarily mean favorite. I have a movie that's high
person.
On my list.
Yeah, and I left it off my
right,
list because
you don't
want to
rewatch
it.
It
again.
Yeah, but I think it's a great movie. I really liked it.
I think mine, I just went for this theme of joy.
Sure.
To where, like, what movies did I have the most fun watching that filled me with the most joy? Are they the best movies I saw this year? No, probably not. I mean, some of them, yeah. Some of them, if I did it, the best movies I saw would also be there. But as far as, like, favorite, what inspired me to do something? What made me happy? So that's where I did this year. And I feel like this is the first year that I felt the most comfortable, because it seems like every year there's movies where it's like, oh, that needs to be in the top 10. And I didn't have that this year. I jot down all the movies I like as I watch them through the year, and then I go through and think, like, is that maybe top 10 worthy? Or did I just like it? So I split them into two categories, and by the time I got to my this is top 10 worthy, I think I had about 18 movies. So then it's a matter of just paring it down to 10.
So yours, would it be safe to say, is like the popular film category that got, but they don't all have to be,
no,
you know, wide releases.
I wouldn't say that, because some of them are bombs.
I can't wait to hear about the Hurricane Heist.
It is number 3. No, it's not.
It's a fine line to walk. As guys that have a movie podcast, I think you're expected, or maybe we're expected, to have all the movies that are going to be Best Picture. That's not what this is. We're not trying
it's
to,
like,
predict.
You know, I don't give a dick about Bohemian Rhapsody. I really don't. I like Queen. I don't care about that movie. Green Room, I'm sure it's fine. I like those actors. That story doesn't really appeal to me.
I guess my list is sort of straddling the fence between stuff that I liked that I thought was a lot of fun, that was very rewatchable. And yeah, I have some stuff that's going to be around for the awards. It's maybe a little bit lower on my list, those movies. But I think what it breaks down to is, on this show, whenever we do a list, we never say these are the best Martin Scorsese movies, or they're the best movies about female action heroes.
I just like that we've both referenced the Martin Scorsese episode.
I did that on purpose.
Does not exist.
Yeah. The female action does exist.
Twice.
Almost existed a third time.
Almost a third time.
But we always say it's our favorite because at the end of the day, we're not trying to be critics. We're just trying to tell you what
and
we
really,
like
we're just
as
trying
if
to
you
talk
care.
About movies.
Yeah.
Like, we enjoy talking about movies we like more than Venom.
Would you like to talk about your 10th favorite movie from this year, Dave?
Well,
I hope the answer is yes.
We often have superhero movies on our show. And
there's one on my list.
They often make our end of year lists. No surprise, I have a superhero movie on my list. And it's an animated superhero movie from 2018. Shocker.
Better be.
Over this summer, it's Teen Titans Go to the Movies. This was one of those that, like, I like Teen Titans enough. I think they're silly. 15-minute episodes are fine because they fit a bunch of jokes in there. I don't need to watch a bunch in a row. So I was hesitant about the movie, but the kids wanted to see it. I had just the biggest smile the whole time, laughing, like, the entire time for this movie because it was one of the funniest comedies I saw this year. And I have no issue saying that. It is one of the funniest comedies I saw all year. It has the little inside jokes that are little Easter eggs for comic fans, which I loved. The songs are great. The characters are good. Will Arnett, Kristen Bell, along with the regular cast. I mean, yeah, I enjoy Teen Titans. I'm not going to say I'm a Teen Titans super fan. It's not like when the South Park movie came out. I loved South Park, so I was stoked for the South Park movie. I enjoy Teen Titans. I loved the movie. I don't buy many movies anymore. I bought Teen Titans Go to the Movies because we've watched it a million times because the kids love it. I can throw it on. The music, I absolutely adore the music. I listen to the soundtrack. When we're in the car, they ask to listen to the soundtrack. It's so fun. And crap, I think His Dad's a Cop is the funniest laugh I've had in a movie this year at all. I broke down. I saw it in theaters over the summer. It was my last MoviePass movie, RIP. I saw it 8 months ago, and I'll just think of things randomly from this movie and just laugh.
My number 10, not animated, not necessarily a comedy. I don't have many movies on my list that you would quantify as straight comedies. They're maybe dramedies. There's a little bit of humor, but a lot of cringing in Bo Burnham's Eighth Grade, starring Elsie Fisher, Josh Hamilton, and Emily Robinson. This movie made me feel so incredibly old. I can sympathize with the awkwardness of being 14, as I'm not sure I've managed to outgrow said awkwardness yet. What is fascinating to me is seeing how there is no escaping that awkwardness in an age where, should you decide to plug in the first place, you can be connected to your peers at all times. Imagine if the Mean Girls had access to your Instagram, or John Bender could call you names via Twitter at all hours of the day. Eighth Grade, for me, is the perfect coming-of-age story for the social media age. It's kind of surprising to me that it has taken until 2018 for a movie to really capture that, but Burnham absolutely succeeds. Much of that success is due to Fisher. The girl was unflinchingly awkward, unsure but somehow hopeful that her own strategies of positivity might just pay off for if she can just stick to him. The more the movie goes, you find yourself just wanting to kind of hug the girl, but at the end of it, it's better that she kind of finds her own way through it and does not require a hug from high school aged male.
I love Bo Burnham. Who better to make a movie about how social media and stuff can affect adolescence for a dude who just started making funny videos for his brother who got deployed? He's built an amazing career out of that. So he knows firsthand the impact social media can have. I did really enjoy this movie. It didn't make my top 10, but a movie that I don't think anybody else saw did. At number 9, directed and written by Jonathan and Josh Baker, it's Ken. This is one of those movies that I think we did an episode related to it, or I talked about it during the...
We did our favorite alien guns.
I think so, yeah. I remember talking about it, and it was one of those where it's like, it looks cool, like it looks like a crime movie, like a chase movie, like a sci-fi movie. Like, I'll check it out, but I have low expectations. And I did. I had really low expectations. But it's really, really good. It's just sci-fi enough to be considered sci-fi. Like, the sci-fi element is really, really good, and at the heart of it is Miles Truitt. this young black kid who was adopted by Dennis Quaid and who has an older brother who's a screw up in jail, and he just constantly feels like he's just the replacement kid. So it's him trying to navigate this upbringing of just feeling like the replacement, the brother, Jack Rayner, who I didn't think I liked, but then looking at his credits, like, oh, he's in a lot of stuff I liked. I just always lumped him in that boring white guy category. He's really good as the brother that gets out of jail, that's just trying to find his way. It's a really good brother story and them growing together. Zoe Kravitz shows up and is really good. Dennis Quaid is fantastic as the dad. Like, I want him as my dad. And then you have cameos from Michael B. Jordan and Carrie Coon, which I thought were awesome. And then just, I like when Franco just lets loose. I like when Franco, it's just, hey, Franco, go be just a methed out bad guy. That's the best Franco to me. There's a lot going for this movie that exceeds very, very low expectations. And it's not just that I turned it on expecting it to be like crap and Venom. It was okay. Yeah, like if Venom would have been okay, you know, this isn't that. This isn't like, oh, this is going to be crap. Oh, it's actually decent. No, it's, oh, this is really, really good. And I really love this story and I love these characters. And it might be the most surprised I've been by a movie this year, just because I like crime movies. I like sci-fi. I like the people in this other than Jack Rayner, but I do now. I just didn't really expect much from it. And I turned out to really, really love this movie.
I have been pounding the Jack Rayner drum on this podcast for a while. Spoiler alert, I'm going to hit it again today, but not for Ken.
He was in the running for McAvoy Award. But then I realized, like, that's mostly people that I just don't like.
Right.
And I never...
Don't like.
Yeah, I never disliked him. The only right. thing, when I hear Jack Rayner, I think, oh, he's the one in the Marky Mark Transformers movie, right? Because I think he is. And that's all I ever thought of. But then I looked, then I checked his credits, and it's like, oh, he's in a lot of stuff that I liked.
He is. I do not have Ken on my list.
Nope, you're an only child.
Nope.
Well, no, you do have a sister. I forgot.
I do, yeah. I don't think she put a list together, but if she did, I don't think this would be on it either. My number 9 features a guy who probably would not have liked Ken. I'm assuming that there is some violence in it, perhaps. Light violence, if even just that. And that square is Mr. Rogers. My number 9 is Won't You Be My Neighbor, the documentary about the aforementioned Mr. Rogers, directed by Morgan Neville. Scores of superheroes banded together this year to stop Thanos from snapping out half of existence. A group of wet-behind-the-ears pilots recanceled the apocalypse, and Laura Jean stared down the barrel at love. But the most heroic and moving moment I saw in anything this year was when Mr. Rogers spoke to Congress in 1969 to save PBS and get public broadcasting $20 million. So much of entertainment nowadays has to be cynical, because that's who we are as human beings. Hell, even our superheroes can't just be white hat guys. We needed a darker Batman. We shit talk Captain America and Superman because they are just good guys. We're always sort of waiting for that other shoe to drop on somebody that we think is a good person. We're trying to see how what they're doing actually has scumbag tendencies behind it. And maybe I'm just being naive, but I really just appreciated a story about a good dude just trying to do good things for kids. I will admit to pulling the plug on the neighborhood when Rogers tried to tell a 7-year-old Ryan that the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles were ruining kids, but I give the guy credit for having a belief, and I believe that Mr. Rogers changed television. It's a fascinating story. And this was a fascinating look at not only that story, but a man who was somehow never the star of the show that had his name on it for 40 years.
There's a fascinating thing. It's from one of the writers on his show about how Mr. Rogers insisted on talking. And I wish I could remember and bring it up now. It's like a 10-step thing of how he wanted Mr. Rogers to talk to kids. And he wanted anything written for him to be like that. It's fascinating. I'm sure it can be found with a quick Google search. It's just 10 simple rules that's like breaks down to everything he says. That's pretty awesome. Number 8, this one we will be hearing about Oscar season, and it had some Golden Globe noms. It is directed by Spike Lee, starring John David Washington and Adam Driver. It is Black Klansman. I was excited for this. I really like the story. I love Topher Grace, and I thought him as David Duke, I thought would be really, really interesting. So I had high hopes for this. I really did. We talk about directors getting in their own way sometimes, and just when Spike Lee gets out of his way, he is a phenomenal director. And this looked like one of those where he was getting out of his way to just tell the story. And he did. He snuck some Spike Lee in there. He snuck enough in there to where it's a Spike Lee movie. And that's fine, because Spike Lee makes good movies. But Adam Driver and John David Washington are so damn fun to watch in this movie. Especially, I think Washington better get an Oscar nom for Best Actor. He deserved the Golden Globe nom that he got. He carries this movie, because in a movie about going undercover in the Ku Klux Klan, there's really not a lot of conflict. That's my only beef with this movie, is that at no point do I really feel like either Ron Swanson or in or Stallworth. It's Ron Stallworth.
Yeah, not Ron Swanson. He was fine, in no danger. He would not like the bureaucracy of the police department.
At no point.
Or the Ku Klux Klan.
Did I feel like either Ron Stallworth was ever in danger? It could have done for a couple of scenes about, oh, they're about to be exposed. Without doing that, it still told a really, really compelling story. And I thought Washington was so fun, just with how he played it, with his phone voice, and just this man talking to David Duke and how he's talking to him. And just it builds up to the end, which is great. The last phone conversation with David Duke, the climax that it leads up to. I really, really like this movie, and I really liked both of them, and Laura Harrier was good in it. Spike Lee is so good. There's a reason he's been making movies for going on 40 years, and that when he does, it's a big deal. This one he deserves a lot of love for, and I hope he gets it. I hope John David Washington and Adam Driver both get nominations, because they both deserve it. It makes me want to read the book. It's based on a true story, and I think that adds to it, knowing that, because at no point does it get too unbelievable. It walks that line, and where sometimes when you're watching based on a true story, it's like oh, that's obviously dramatized. This one's tough to know exactly what was enhanced and dramatized, which makes it feel more real.
More on that one later.
Moron. Don't call me a moron.
My number 8 is also an animated superhero movie. Why the hell not? It is directed by Bob Prashadi and Peter Ramsey. It's Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, starring Shameik Moore, Jake Johnson, and Hailee Steinfeld. There were a ton of superhero movies this year. I don't think there were any better than Spider-Man. I really liked The Avengers as well, but at this point, we're just continually seeing great stuff from Marvel. And for Sony to take the chances that they did, hire the writers they did at the time they hired them, and make a Spider-Man movie featuring Miles Morales, I thought was more than welcome. The movie is creative beyond all measure. It's incredibly visually unique and has a great story that we haven't seen done time after time yet. I have no problem with folks wanting Black Panther to be nominated for Best Picture. Hell, I wanted Logan to be nominated a couple years back. But Into the Spider-Verse, I think, is a much better movie than Black Panther. I love the character of Miles Morales. If we want to have more minorities in superhero movies, I think that's great, but I don't know why it shouldn't be Miles. I think as a character, it may be even more easy to relate to him being a kid from New York than some guy who's a king in an African nation. I'm not a Black kid from New York, but it felt very authentic. I liked the music, the sneakers, the tagging. I thought that was all a really authentic character that didn't have to get sacrificed because, oh yeah, he's Spider-Man too. I loved the treatment of his character. I thought it was nice how they brought all the other Spider characters in, but you never lost the sight of this is a movie about Miles. It's about his relationship with the men in his family. It was just a great movie, much better than I thought it was going to be. And I love Spider-Man movies, all of them, but this is my favorite.
Number 7 is a perfect testament to why I love Netflix and why I will live or die by Netflix, and I want them to make as many original movies as possible. My number 7 is a movie I would not have paid money to go see at the movie theaters, but I watched the day it went up, and it was one of the most fun times I had watching a movie this year. It is directed by Claire Scanlon, written by Katie Silberman, starring Zoe Deutsch and Glenn Powell, Lucy Liu, and Taye Diggs. It's Set It Up. It's your basic romantic comedy. This movie felt like it was released in late 90s. It's a simple premise. Two, assistants that really don't have any life balance because their bosses are just workaholics figure, let's get our bosses hooked up. So it's them two trying to hook their bosses up, and maybe, just maybe, they'll fall in love with each other along the way.
I bet they will.
Yeah. Zoe Deutsch, I adore her so much. I will watch her in anything. She brings this charm and charisma that, you know, we talk about Anna Kendrick a lot. She brings a lot of that charm and that snark that Anna Kendrick does, but with less edge, more friendly almost. But it's so good. There are so many good scenes. It's legitimately funny. It's a really good comedy. Her and Glenn Powell's dynamic between the two is great. Lucy Liu and Taye Diggs are really fun because even though they're at the center of the movie, they're not carrying the movie. So they both got to have just a little fun, and it just felt like both of them just kind of let loose, which was a lot of fun to see. It's super well written. It's just a really, really funny movie, and I absolutely adored this movie.
It does feel very much like a romantic comedy that was released a lot in the 80s and 90s. It felt a little bit more modern than maybe the jokes. But apart from that, you could see Zoe Deutsch's mom, Leah Thompson, in a role just like this. So in that respect, I think it's great. It's a great example of some movies that just don't get released anymore, but it was a good year
Netflix
for those on
Netflix.
Netflix
is keeping them alive. Yeah,
yeah, they are.
We'll see with my 1 through 5.
Yeah, I have no doubt. I had mentioned just watching movies last night, and I watched 2, and my number 7 is one of them. And it's one that I noticed on a lot of best of lists. I hadn't really noticed it getting award nominations, but people really seemed to like it. And as I was perusing the video store, I ran across Blindspotting, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna grab this. That is the movie that is directed by Carlos Lopez Estrada, whom you may not know, but it was written by the stars David Diggs and Rafael Casal. There is a lot going on in Blindspotting, most of which I cannot relate to. The movie makes it abundantly clear that I can't relate to it as well. I am not now, nor have I ever been black. So I don't know what it's like to interact with police as a person of color, and the only thing I know about Oakland is their basketball team once blew a 3-1 lead in the finals. The movie should have a relatively narrow appeal. It is a love letter of sorts to Oakland, but Diggs and Casal, who wrote and star in the movie, do a fantastic job of portraying these struggles and making them relatable to someone like me while being entertaining. There are genuine laughs in this movie. There's a ton of them. At times, it feels like a straight-up comedy. There's a rather unique use of rap in this movie, which you would expect from a rapper and a spoken word artist. It doesn't feel out of place at all. Tonally, the movie does shift from ridiculous comedy to the climax of the movie is a really tense scene with Lafayette rapping one of the best movie speeches that I can remember in a long time. We did our favorite movie speech episode a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago.
A year ago, July. Or yeah. Whenever Independence Day 2
came. Resurgence came out, yeah. This would be in there for sure. I think it's phenomenal. The rapping never felt out of place. It was just organic to the characters, to the story. And it's heavy subject matter. It really is. But it didn't seem preachy. It didn't lecture me for not already coming in and knowing the struggle. And I think it did a great job of making its point. I am both pictures.
It's a different movie than If Beale Street Could Talk, but it's similar in a lot of ways that I feel like is easy to lump them together, which is sad because they're both good movies, but they're different. I feel like this, if it came out last year or maybe even next year, it gets a lot more attention. I do like David Diggs. I love seeing how many people from Hamilton are just getting huge now and turning into movie or Netflix stars. I think that's great. My number 6, talk about the cast of Hamilton being great. My number 6 stars Viola Davis, Liam Neeson, John Bernthal, Michelle Rodriguez, Elizabeth Debicki, Robert Duvall, Colin Farrell, Brian Tyree Henry, Carrie Coon. There's more than just I ran out of room on the page. Written by Gillian Flynn and Steve McQueen, directed by Steve McQueen. It is Widows. I really loved this movie. This movie runs for 2 hours. Usually by the end of a 2-hour movie, it's like, ah, oh, that that was fine. That could have lost about 20 minutes and been fine. This is one of those movies where it's like, oh, I want another hour. Every character in this movie, Daniel Kaluuya's in it. There's so many good people in this movie. And every one of them does not get enough screen time. Every character is so well done. It's such a beautifully crafted movie about loss and survival and a heist movie about betrayal. It's so good. Viola Davis carries this movie. I'm surprised this didn't get any Golden Globe nominations that I know of. I think it went. McQueen for directing should be up there. Gillian Flynn didn't get the nomination for Gone Girl that she should have. Her and him should get this because it's such a great, wonderfully crafted script. And just Liam Neeson's always good, but at this stage in his career, with what Liam Neeson does and what you're used to seeing him in, seeing him how he was in Widows was such a welcome change, because you forget, like, this dude's a really good actor and has been for a long time before he just turned angry snowplow driver. It's just such a good movie. And again, underuses Carrie Coon. She's in it a little bit more than Ken, but still not enough. But that's everybody in this movie. By the end of it, I just want more of everybody. From top to bottom, it's one of the best acted, directed, written movies I saw this year. And that's typical from Steve McQueen, because he delivers consistently.
This is one of those that I would certainly keep an eye on for the Oscars. I know it didn't get the Golden Globe love, but this is a weird year. Usually the Golden Globes, I think, are a good predictor of what's going to happen in the Oscars.
I don't think, though, this year.
I agree. Maybe I have a higher expectation for what the Academy is going to do, but I would be really surprised if Steve McQueen doesn't get a directing nom here. I could see Flynn, like you said.
I mean, if you don't nominate Viola Davis, I think her and Toni Collette, there should be three nominations open for Best Actress, because if you don't give Viola Davis and Toni Collette one, then why even have them this year? You know, the Golden Globes have two Best Picture categories,
right,
so they can give the least deserving film in two categories the Best Picture.
I don't see a ton of Oscar love coming the way of my number six, except for maybe Best Original Screenplay. I could see Boots Riley picking one up for Sorry to Bother You There, starring Lakeith Stanfield, Tessa Thompson, and Steven Yeun. Holy shit. Sorry to Bother You manages to take what is a crazy premise, black folk using a white voice to advance their career, complete with white voiceovers, and somehow makes that the most grounded part of the story. There's a left turn in this movie that even if I wanted to spoil it for you, you would absolutely think I was just fucking with you. There's no way that this movie does that. Well, it does. The silliness of this movie can either bury the message or make the viewer more willing to listen, in my opinion. And I think that's where Riley succeeds. He can make a statement on blackness or exploitation of minorities, but because he rewards the viewer with some laughs, it seems to make the message, as uncomfortable as it may be to some white folks, more palatable. I really, really liked this movie. I mean, we talked already, a movie where a black guy goes and sounds white on the phone. We've had a couple movies this year where that is a key part of the plot, and they've both been outstanding. This one played it a lot more for laughs, but I thought it was still a really good movie. It was well done from Riley.
My number five also got overlooked by the Golden Globes.
It's Hurricane Heist.
Closer than you think. It is written and directed by Stephen DeKnight, starring John Boyega, Scott Eastwood, and Kaylee Spaney, who puts on a very Haley Steinfeld-like performance in Pacific Rim Uprising. I have such a soft spot in my entire body for Pacific Rim. It was everything I wanted out of a movie that's entire premise was, let's have giant robots fight giant monsters. And it worked. People didn't like it. I don't know what you were expecting from a movie that is literally giant robots fighting giant monsters. There was enough there to keep it more than that. I thought
there were enough giant robots,
yes,
and enough giant monsters.
Idris Elba was great. And then you have the second one. I absolutely loved it. I love John Boyega. I like John Boyega as an actor. And him as Jake Pentecost, this dude who's got a legendary name but wants nothing to do with it, that's just trying to survive in this, like, underworld that he can. And then Kaylee Spaney, I thought she's really, really, really good. And you know what? For a sequel to a movie about giant robots fighting giant monsters, there isn't a lot of giant robots fighting giant monsters. But I'm here for it because it builds up to it that finally, you know, you have a giant robot versus giant robot, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But when you finally get to giant robots versus giant monsters, it's worth it. It builds up the characters so much better than the first one did.
They're not just in there to die.
Yeah, and I feel like this one was made to launch a cartoon, toy. Like, it felt like that. It was the Power Rangers of Pacific Rim, and I loved it. Is it a good movie? Fuck yeah, it's a good movie. It's a great movie. Is it one of the best of the year? Yes. Does anybody agree with me? No. But I don't care because leaving the theater, I had one of the biggest smiles on my face leaving Pacific Rim Uprising because it gave me everything I wanted out of a sequel to a movie about giant robots fighting giant monsters. And I loved every second of it.
Then if you think about it, Pacific Rim did not need a sequel. They pretty well tied everything
up. They did. My biggest beef is that Jax survived, that Charlie Hunnam lived. Mm. Kill him off, and especially if you're not going to bring him back
for
the sequel.
Right, yeah.
He's not coming back for the sequel anyway. Just kill him off. That was my only beef, and it wrapped up nicely. But when you have giant robots versus giant monsters, that's a franchise.
It is, but I thought they did a much better job this time of leaving it open. They didn't kill everybody, other than Jack.
They didn't just leave it open.
Yeah.
They teased the third one.
Yeah, they did.
Tell them we're coming to them. Yes!
And you know what?
I want a giant robot invading giant monster movie. Give me Pacific Rim 3, but I don't think we'll get it.
Fuck it. I'll watch it.
I will too. I'll be there opening day like I was for Uprising.
Was it my favorite movie of the year? No. Was it an awful lot of fun? Absolutely. Will I watch as many Pacific Rims as they want to make? You bet.
Will I watch the cartoon that's coming, I think, to Netflix? Absolutely. Have I watched this at least 4 or 5 times since it hit HBO streaming? Yes. Will I watch it again? Absolutely. This movie does so well, and I could go on, but
I was allowing you
The John Boyega, Scott Eastwood relationship, I think is so well done. And so understated, because in so many of these movies, you have the hardcore soldier boy and the renegade who doesn't want to be it, and they're just opposites. But they played this that way to an extent where they just went different paths. Eastwood's this big soldier boy. Pentecost is this guy who doesn't want anything to do with it. But there's human moments between them. You can tell they have a history.
Once upon a time, they liked each other.
And yeah, that they're still those dudes that liked each other. They're just in different places now. And John Boyega putting whipped cream on his ice cream. And how many toppings do you need? Love it. I want to watch this movie right now. We will come back and record the rest of the 5 after we all go watch Pacific Rim Uprising.
My number 5 is a movie that may be one of the most rewatchable. I think it is, for me, the most rewatchable movie this year. At least that is the movie that I want to watch the most. It's also the most fluid movie on my list, meaning that depending on when you catch me, it goes anywhere from 5 to 1. And that might just be depending on how recently I have seen The Ballad of Buster Scruggs by Joel and Ethan Coen, starring a ton of people, not a methed out James Franco, but a somewhat villainous James Franco nonetheless. Zoe Kazan, the snowplow driving Liam Neeson, Tim Blake Nelson, etc., etc. I love the Coen brothers, and I love the stories that they choose to tell, and The Ballad of Buster Scruggs features 6 of those, most of which are exceedingly dark, but with some of the absolute most beautiful cinematography you've ever seen. I forget who it was, but there was an organization that just released their top 100 moments in cinematography this week. I think Lawrence of Arabia was maybe number 1.
They didn't come out this week, though.
No, Lawrence of Arabia did not come out this week, no. The list did. Oh. But there is some absolute beautiful filmography in The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. Just beautiful pictures. A bit like a travelogue of some places that are far too dangerous for me to ever want to go, especially if it's just as dangerous as the Coens make you believe that it is. I also love anthology movies. So if the Coens were going to make an anthology movie, that you'd think that's almost made specifically for me. And I kind of felt that it was. Like I said, it is the most rewatchable movie I've seen this year. And if that's only because you can watch it in segments, I can watch the Buster Scruggs segment for the first 20 minutes, walk away, go do something else, and come back. Or if I'm trying to watch the Mortal Remains segment to figure out if I know what the hell's going on. I really, really like this movie. It got me in a hell of a Western phase that I don't think I've clawed out of yet. But damn it, I will keep crawling back in there to watch Buster Scruggs.
My number four. A lot of times we might get uppity on our lists and like leave off some superhero movies that may make it. And I do the same thing.
We get uppity on a list that just had Pacific Rim.
Yes. Yeah. Sometimes.
And Ken.
Yeah. Sometimes we're a little bit film snobby. But sometimes we just leave off obvious ones. But in a year where we got Ant-Man and the Wasp, which I loved, Black Panther, which I loved, and Avengers Infinity War, which was literally 10 years in the making, I can't not have one of them on my list. So at number four, I kind of encapsulate everything in Avengers Infinity War. It's an event movie. I've sat through at least two Marvel movies every year for the last 10 years, but something about going at, I went at like 10:20 in the morning the day Infinity War opened. There are events that I feel Willow is one of the first ones of like, I really want to see this movie. Oh, I'm visiting family in St. Louis. I won't get to see it for a couple of weeks. And then they surprised me and went. And it was one of those where it's like, this is the greatest day of my life. Force Awakens, I had to leave. I had a 40-minute panic attack in the middle of the first time seeing it just because I was overwhelmed with emotions. That's what this felt like. This was 10 years in the making that, yes, I've seen these characters over and over and over again. But to still feel like this, like episode 7, I still had that anticipation and that desire and want to see it, like a movie who I hadn't seen in a new one of in 30 years.
If you don't count the prequels.
To pull that off, and then to be a really good movie as well. For how I am into movies and how emotionally attached I get to movies, sometimes the movie is hard to match up to that feeling it gives me. Infinity War is pretty damn close, and I think a big thing with Marvel movies is I feel like they're made to be event movies and they're not always the most rewatchable. We both experienced that with Black Panther. Like, Black Panther's a really good movie. Rewatching it, not as into it. Doctor Strange was one of those where loved it leaving the theater. Rewatching it, even Ragnarok to an extent. But Infinity War, I've rewatched a few times since I had Netflix on Christmas, and I enjoy it. Like, it's a really, really good movie. It's really good performances, and I don't know how that after movies like that, well, Venom is how, but after movies like this, that there's still that stigma about superhero movies. They're almost looked down upon, that they're not like legitimate. But like, you look at some of the performances in here, like Hemsworth is a fucking emotional like powerhouse in this movie. Downey Jr., Tom Holland, like everybody is really, really good in this movie. That's what you get when you take 10 years of let's cast really, really good actors and let's let them act, not just punch, punch, kick, kick.
This one, I don't want to say that I left it off, but I've been taking the cop out of disqualifying it because you said it's an event, and it is. We have been building to Thanos for 10 years, and then we get to that. They delivered. It did not feel like a waste of 10 years after seeing this movie, but yet I feel like it's not done.
It's a part one.
Right. It's very obviously a part one. And we weren't doing this when the Lord of the Rings movie came out, but like, would I have left the Fellowship of the Ring off because it was very clearly part one? No, I probably wouldn't have done that.
Would we have waited till Return of the King to give it our number one when clearly the second one was the best one and should have gotten every award?
The second one, I think, is probably my favorite because it has a lot of kick-ass
in it. It's good.
But Infinity War, it hit that event, and almost like no other movie this year, we knew what we were gonna get. We were gonna get Thanos, we were gonna get him with the gauntlet, all five stones together. There's gonna be some stakes in this movie. I don't want to say that we knew the plot going in.
To add to that point that you're making, we knew what we were gonna get, but they still shocked and surprised us.
They did, but you knew that there was such potential for this event to just be so great. There was almost no way for them to not let you down. But as Marvel has been doing, they take what seems like a they can't possibly pull off Civil War with all of these characters. Like, somebody's going to get the short end of the stick and it's going to kind of suck. No. Every time I think, okay, this is going to be where they falter, they don't. And after Infinity War, I thought Ant-Man and the Wasp, which is probably not going to make our lists, but I thought that was a nice breather, but yet it still harkened back to that. Captain Marvel is going to be a tremendous lead-in to Endgame. They have got such momentum now that, yeah, it would be very easy for us to just have whatever Marvel movies at the top of our list, because if you've ever listened to this show, you know how much we like them.
Because you know what? I think overall, I think I might have enjoyed Ant-Man and the Wasp more from like an enjoyment standpoint, because I really like the Ant-Man movies. But I had to use this one. Once the fades to black, the first time I saw it, that is a feeling I will never forget. I don't know that anything compare. I think the closest I get to that feeling of like, what, really? I think the closest is seeing Blair Witch Project opening weekend with a packed theater when it ends and everybody's just like, what?
Did they just kill the Black Panther? Like, nah, they didn't. It's going to be okay. They did not kill the $700 million man. You'll be fine.
This movie's always going to have a special place in my heart and my memories.
My number four is also on Netflix, and that is the only way you were able to see it this year. It has been a good year for Netflix movies. It's also been a pretty good year for horror movies. And my number four is a movie that was on my halftime list, so I'm not going to talk a lot about it. But after a bunch of good movies this year, very few things have impacted me like Ben Howling and Yolanda Ramke's Cargo, starring a guy that was in some of those Rings movies and the Avengers movies, actually. Martin Freeman, Anthony Haynes, and Susie Poitier. My number two movie also features a really great performance by an actress in a horror movie. And Freeman, I think, is every bit as good in Cargo. On this show, Dave talks a lot about Train to Busan, and I think that those smaller zombie stories, whether it's 28 Days Later, that has a relatively small group of survivors that we follow, those are the zombie stories that I think are more, they resonate more with us because it's about the characters. You care about the characters. You legitimately want them to be okay. And I think that's where Cargo just knocks it out of the park. Freeman is magnificent. There's this inevitability to the story from almost the first 10 minutes in, and his performance is kind of equally inevitable but determined. And in a movie that it doesn't seem possible to have a happy ending, Cargo kind of manages that. It's ball punch after ball punch, but with the plucky determination of a loving father that is Martin Freeman. It's not a guy you'd think is going to carry. Not that Cargo's a horror movie, quote unquote. It's a story about father trying to look out for his daughter. Just happens to be a bunch of zombies running around.
I'm honestly shocked this was this high up your list. I didn't realize you liked it that much.
I like it a lot.
Yeah, it was one of my last ones. It was in that last bunch to get cut out of the 10. Really, really good. Freeman's great. It's just such a good movie. It's a good year for Netflix all around. We'll get more into that in my also-rans, though. My number three is something you mentioned earlier, written and directed by Boots Riley, starring Lakeith Stanfield, Tessa Thompson, Amari Hardwick, Terry Crews, Jermaine Fowler. I really loved Sorry to Bother You. I went in expecting this fun comedy about this guy who rises the ranks of telemarketing by using his white voice.
And you get that
in the first like half hour.
Yeah.
And then you don't know what you get after that. And it's so good. But I'm a Lakeith Stanfield dude. I want him leading every movie. So if you put Lakeith Stanfield in a movie, like leading it, I'm into it already. Plus Tessa Thompson and the rest of the cast. Armie Hammer was really, really great in this movie. I love Armie Hammer in this movie. But there is a but on this movie. This is a very, very, very fantastic script. This script, I think, should get nominated for Best Original Screenplay because it's so bonkers. It's so out there. It says everything it needs to do. But it's handed to a first-time director, and it shows. The movie is much better written than directed, and there are points in it where I feel like maybe I'd have liked it directed by somebody else, but yet it's written so well that you don't know if that comes out with somebody else taking this vision. But it is get me excited to see what Boots Riley does next, more so as a writer, but as it's well enough directed that, like, yeah, it's a good first-time director movie, but I feel like the script is way better than the direction, the ending, the lead-up to it. Just, why didn't you just have me check your nostrils? Like, that's one of the funniest lines in a movie this year. Like, I love that because it comes at such a serious moment. It's this ridiculously slapsticky funny line that makes perfect sense. It's not out of place, but it's delivered in just this really intense time. And the makeup and the effects, I think, are great. I really liked this movie. I went in expecting to like it, and it blew me away how much I liked it, because it was not what I expected, because I don't think it's what anybody expected, because I don't think anybody goes into this movie and expects this.
You can't. We expected Thanos to collect all the Infinity Stones. I did not expect the plot that Armie Hammer hatches in this one. My number three is also a first-time director. That director is John Krasinski, directing his wife, Emily Blunt, and Millie Simmons in A Quiet Place. We've talked a lot about A Quiet Place this year. Yeah, we did an episode this year. It was on my halftime report. Spoiler alert, it's really, really good. And I think, you know, you could put Blunt's performance right up there with any other actresses that'll get an Oscar nom this year. Krasinski showed a ton of talent behind the camera. And we had some really, really great original ideas. I mean, I think Sorry to Bother You fits right in with that, mixed in with your biopics and comic stuff. But I think, it, at least in terms of this, Krasinski's story and direction really caught me off guard, because I thought both were outstanding. Whereas I agree with you, like, if Sorry to Bother You may have been directed by, like, F. Gary Gray, it's probably a much better movie. He's a fantastic director. It's taken not much away from Boots Riley, but that was a really well-done script. I thought A Quiet Place was a really, really interesting idea, and I thought Krasinski did interesting things behind the camera. And recently, Q1 has been this great time to release some sneaky good horror movies, so maybe I should have paid a bit more attention to this, although it did just kind of bleed into Q2. But I really couldn't have imagined just how great of a movie-going experience Jim Halpert would deliver. And to me, that's one of those things. I think we get spoiled nowadays. We're like, I'll wait for, you know, Netflix or Redbox or Amazon or On Demand, whatever. But there's a couple movies this year. I mean, Into the Spider-Verse, I think, is fantastic to see in the theaters. A Quiet Place was also phenomenal.
It's an experience movie.
It is. There are reasons to get out and go to the theater. I know it's expensive. I know it can be a pain in the ass. But movies like this make it worth it.
Yeah, it's not an event movie like Infinity War, but it's an experience movie. Like Blair Witch Project, I'll bring it up again. Paranormal Activity.
Yep.
I'm glad I saw that in the theater.
We did our five favorite movie-going experiences, and those were two that were on there.
My number two, not a first-time director. You know, we have a lot of superhero movies on here. And a common theme is man
gets bit by spider.
It's about a man whose body bonds with something that he's unfamiliar with, and it's shenanigans as he learns how to use this new friend that's inside him. It's talking to him. Is it him? Is it somebody else? And of course, it is Upgrade, the movie Venom wished it could be. Written and directed by Lee Wannell, starring
Tom Hardy,
now Logan Marshall Green.
Oh, shit. Congratulations, LMG.
I love this movie. It's one of those that it's made for me. It's got that sci-fi element. It's got a crime element. It's funny. I like Logan Marshall Green. It's got all this stuff working for it. It's making a lot of year-end horror lists, which I'm not. I can see it,
yeah, I can
but
see
it's
it.
I don't. It's like The Guest to me. I don't see The Guest as a horror movie, but I could see
it. I think it's horror in the way that people think Black Mirror is horror.
Yeah, but I really like this movie. The premise, the setup. It's Logan Marshall Green getting this implant that upgrades him, and it's a computer that takes over. And he's so good. The scene in the kitchen where he's hitting a dude with the plates and he's like begging himself to stop is so good. It's really, really good, and it's predictable to a point and then still takes a turn to surprise you. He's just so good, and he pulls this intensity and this hilarity off. It's not a feel-good movie. I wouldn't say
it's the Black Mirror comparison.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's a feel-good movie, But man, it's a lot of fun. And for as much as James Wan is like this big mega movie director, $1 billion guy, coming out of that same movie, literally, like his buddy growing up,
Saw.
Lee Whannell, he's had a hell of a career, both writing and his directing stuff. He's built a really good career out of it. But I thought Upgrade was so much fun and just so ridiculous. And the action is really, really good. That fight scene with the standing up, like it's just...
In the bathroom, yeah.
Yeah, I really, really like this movie. And Logan Marshall Green pulls it off. It is funny because it is the same movie as Venom, but much, much better.
With fake-ass Tom Hardy supplanting actual Tom Hardy and earning his name. That's a redemption
Venom
story.
Venom starring fake-ass Logan Marshall Green. I take it back. I take it back.
Come full circle. I like it.
No, I can't.
My number two is, I have referenced a couple times already on the podcast about the outstanding female performance, which Dave mentioned by name, and a movie that I will rewatch. I purchased it, so I have every intent of rewatching Hereditary. You just got to let it breathe for a little bit. I'm directed by Ari Aster.
It's not safe to have the windows down, though.
It is, as long as everyone's stationary. It's fine. Starring the aforementioned Toni Collette and Millie Shapiro and Alex Wolff. This was a fantastic year for horror. I feel like we said that almost from the beginning of the year. Oftentimes, it's not mainstream horror that carries the banner. But while I would not exactly call A24 horror mainstream, by continuing to release titles like Hereditary, they make as much noise as anybody. An uncomfortable watch, to be sure, but it's an incredible mashup of Rosemary's Baby and The Wicker Man, with all the atmospheric dread that A24 horror has been known to pack in, along with that incredible performance by Collette. It's not a great performance for a horror movie. It is a goddamn incredible performance for any movie by Collette, period. I may not rewatch this as much as some other movies on the list, but I will certainly check out what Ari Aster does next. And it doesn't hurt that his next movie, Midsommar, sounds like another spiritual brother to Wicked Man, starring Will Poulter and Jack Rayner. I'm in it.
I like Jack Rayner.
And Will Poulter.
I really do like Will Poulter. My number one... You also mentioned it earlier, but and normally we'll bounce around, but I couldn't.
Nope, we're not doing that. Not today.
I couldn't today because no movie hit me as hard emotionally, spiritually, as a moviegoer, as a dad.
Sexually.
Always had a Spider-Gwen thing. As Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. There aren't enough good things I can say. Like, this movie is the only one the Golden Globes got right, where it was Best Animated Feature. But what they got wrong is that it wasn't nominated for Best Feature. It should get an Oscar nomination for Best Picture. It absolutely should. And that's not just like, oh, it's good for a superhero movie. This is a damn good movie. It's got everything that you look for in a movie. You take any Oscar movie and what makes it an Oscar movie, this has all of it.
Whatever argument you want to use for Black Panther, can't you use the same thing for Into the Spider-Verse?
Yeah.
Except maybe Black Panther has better music. I'll give it that.
Oh, see, I don't know. Both those soundtracks are really, really good. The Black Panther soundtrack's really, really good, but I listen to the Into the Spider-Verse soundtrack more because of the variety on it. I mean, Start a Riot is probably one of my favorite songs this year. I made a favorites of 2018 favorite songs playlist, and Start a Riot by Duckworth from this soundtrack is one of like five songs on it. I didn't get very far, but I love the soundtrack. I love the music. I love the performances. Shameik Moore, who I'm big on from Dope, he's a great Miles Morales. Chris Pine is probably my favorite Peter Parker ever. Instantly, Chris Pine is so good in this movie.
It does make you want a Chris Pine Spider-Man movie.
Yes, it does. But it also makes me want a Jake Johnson Spider-Man movie. It makes me want a Hailee Steinfeld Spider-Gwen movie. I want a Spider-Noir movie. I absolutely love it. And I say this as a white dude. Like, so this might take this with a grain of salt. Black Panther was huge. It was this first black headlining superhero in this.
That's not Blade
or Blank Man or like in this era. That was a black movie, but it was good. I loved it. I do, but it was very. African, and it just it embraced it, and it was great, and it made it feel like this is their movie, and it was great. Where Spider-Man does is it's not taking it to Africa. It's not making it this separate culture. It's this kid from Brooklyn. And it's not he's this king of this country that has to protect. He's a kid from Brooklyn that's honestly with all these white people trying to do well. He was one of them. And it was a very immersive movie. And it wasn't just like, oh, we can have our superhero movie, but it's in Africa. He is the hero here. And you have so many superhero movies where the origin stories are just so boring because it's just, oh, they have these great talents, but they don't want to be a hero. So that the arc is them learning how to want to be a hero. Whereas Miles is different. Miles wants to be the hero. He just isn't yet. So it's that drive, and it's refreshing to see somebody that wants to save the day, that isn't saving the day begrudgingly. The scene of him after he gets the black suit and him fighting Kingpin and him hugging his dad, like, I saw it on opening day because I wanted to see it, and I couldn't get the kids to see it. I took the kids again. Honestly, like, I have no shame saying this. Like, the second time seeing it, I was, like, holding back tears the entire time for anything to make me feel like that. The way this movie made me feel, this movie made me want to go create everything. This movie made me want to go write, draw, create anything to make anybody feel an ounce of how this movie made me feel. And it was so inspiring and so good. Like, it's really, really good. It's not just a good superhero movie. It's a fantastic movie. The writing, the soundtrack, the acting, everything about it. And it looks great. The Easter eggs, the Seth Rogen poster, the Steph Curry is the golfer. Like, there's so much stuff hidden in this movie that I could watch it over and over again. And I will. I have every intention to. I couldn't make it my number 8 like you did. I had to wait. Usually my number 1 can be interchanged, but this year it couldn't be because this was so far ahead of everything else. This was my number 1 without a doubt. It could be its own episode, and then everything else is in a different stratosphere.
I don't think I had that feeling about my number. I like my number 1. I think it is the best movie that I saw this year. I think it's the best made. I like it a lot. I would rewatch it a ton. I offered to rewatch it the same weekend I rented it, and I watched it without Sarah, and she was like, "Ah, I wanted to see that." I was like, "Oh, fine. We'll watch it again. This is great. I don't care." I didn't want to change it because you had already mentioned it, and I didn't want to, I don't know. This is my list. We're telling people what we liked the most, so I didn't want to change it. I'm glad you didn't either, but I'm not going to spend a ton of time.
Yeah, I mean, we really only had the 2 crossovers, and we didn't switch them up like we did, and I felt like they were far enough apart. It worked.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, you mentioned Black Klansman quite a while ago, and I was like, fuck it. It's still going to be the number 1 on my list for many of the reasons that you said. I think Klansman was one of the few examples of a movie that had Oscar written all over it this year that actually delivered. So many times this year, movies were disappointing at best, god-awful at worst. But Klansman not only lived up to the hype, but exceeded it. Somehow, by making the least Spike Lee movie that I can remember Spike Lee doing, he may finally be recognized with the award that has eluded not just Spike Lee, but African-American filmmakers in general. John David Washington became a goddamn movie star, and Driver continues to tackle and succeed in becoming one of the best character actors working. I think Black Klansman is really, really funny and tense at times. I do think the scene at the end of the movie where you can see the wheels start turning, where the guy recognizes Adam Driver as the cop that put him in jail. Like, you can kind of see where, okay, they could get caught here. The scene, and it's mostly involving Driver, where he's in the garage and he pick up that gun, that whole scene. Like, I do think that there's an awful lot of tension in the movie. And I will admit that at times it does get preachy. And I think those are the Spike Lee moments. Those are the things that maybe were dramatized for the film. But I do think it's a great story told expertly by an expert filmmaker. And I think by any metric, this one might have the best shot at winning the awards, which doesn't necessarily make it the best, but it's a movie I liked an awful lot. And I do think that critically, standing back, taking myself out of it. My favorite movie of the year probably might be Infinity War. But I think that looking at it with that critical lens, a movie that I liked a lot and I think was really, really good was Klansman for me.
I was just looking up Adam Driver. Like, he's a movie star. So I don't think people consider him like a character actor, but he is.
Right.
Like, he is. And Spike Lee, Scorsese, Soderbergh, Jeff Nichols, like, this dude has worked with the best directors out there. Inside Man is the least Spike Lee movie, I think, but
that's
which is a
accurate.
Really good movie, yeah. But that's not an awards movie. Did you have any? I had a lot. Did you have any that you felt bad leaving out of your top 10?
That I felt bad? I mean, there were some that were close. I liked Halloween a lot. That was fun. I thought it was great. Searching was really good.
Searching was surprisingly good. You hadn't seen it last. I remember telling you, like, mm-hmm. Watch Searching. It was surprising. It should have gotten the uppie for way better than it should have been.
Was it nominated?
No.
Okay.
Because,
well,
I don't know the way.
Fair enough. I like that Cam movie from Netflix quite a bit, too. That was cool. I mean,
it was different.
Not necessarily to the Black Mirror level, but I think we're seeing a lot of technology gone awry things. I liked Isle of Dogs too, but that's just me and Anderson, I guess. It's a good year for me with directors I like. There was a Wes Anderson movie, there was a Coen Brothers movie. So, I mean, those ones were, I'm not saying like I'm sad I left them off the list. I'm not sad I left any movies off. It's just that's where they fell.
I think the ones that got the hardest to leave off, the last ones to get cut of that like 18 that got cut down, Quiet Place. It should have been on my top 10. It didn't. I knew you would bring it up, so and we did an episode on it. Solo, I really like. Ant-Man and the Wasp, but I didn't want both. And I'd have got, you think Ken or Pacific Rim Uprising is Happy Time Murders. I really, really liked that movie. I thought it was great, but I love Melissa McCarthy. Puppets Fucking, I'm Always For. I love it. Cargo, Hereditary, we're right behind it. Stupid and Futile Gesture was one of the first movies I saw in the year. I loved it. That was Netflix. To All the Boys I Loved Before, Netflix. I really like Bird Box. I like the memes that it's created more, but I thought Bird Box was done well. I like the intensity. That's the top tier of, like, these are the ones that are list worthy. And then just a bunch of stuff that I liked. Like, nothing. Like, Summer of 84 was cool.
Yeah, that was good.
Overlord I thought was cool. Equalizer 2 I really liked. I would watch a dozen Equalizer movies.
That's tough, because once you get past, and I have the same problem, once you get past like the top tier ones, I like a lot of shit.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Same here.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I have Mile 22 and Spy Who Dumped Me and Super Troopers 2 and Apostle, like Proud Mary and The Meg. Like, that's the kind of movies. Like, anything I enjoy, I try to jot down so that at the end of the year, it's not struggling to come up.
I just write down fucking everything.
And the thing is I've deleted Rank along them. The way. Like, I've deleted throughout the year, like, stuff. That
50 Shades Freed got deleted.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was the worst movie I saw this year.
I don't know that.
And I can say that because I list everything, and that's the one that every time I wrote a movie, it went higher than 50 Shades Freed.
I don't know that I have a worse that I don't know that I could come up with. And I've shit on Venom. I can understand the appeal of Venom. I didn't like it. Is there anything you haven't seen that you feel like could make your list?
Oh, shit. Destroyer, we both like Kasama a lot. That's one that probably would make it. You mentioned Melissa McCarthy.
Yeah. Those are the two.
Can You Ever Forgive Me? Yeah.
Those are the two that, like, I feel like if I had seen them, they'd be at least in the running based on expectations. But, like, I feel like I've seen pretty much everything else that I want to see.
Green Book I probably would have had on the list somewhere. I have a feeling, like, that's a movie I'd like an awful lot. I just haven't gotten around to seeing it yet. I guess that would be it, though.
Mary Poppins, I haven't seen yet. But I like Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Yeah, he was in that play, too, with Daveed Diggs, wasn't he?
Rapping President.
I think so, yeah. A guy that did not get mentioned in any of our movies this week, but has had a hell of a career, Bruce Willis will be the subject of our list episode next week.
Glass
comes out, which we were going to do our favorite McAvoy movies, which would have been at least the same three, maybe with a couple twos thrown in there.
Yeah,
but
we've
Bruce
already
Willis
done
is,
Sammy Jackson.
Yeah, Willis has got a long career. We've done, I think, our favorite Shyamalan movies too, so we were really painted into
it
a corner.
It wasn't really our favorite. We did the filmography
That's
of
accurate.
Shyamalan.
That's accurate.
Yeah, we did it from top to bottom.
Because there's a couple we liked, and then there's the rest of the
So,
Shyamalan
I mean, we got
movies.
Glass pretty much covered. I assumed we had done a Bruce Willis episode. Nope.
Have not.
So, that's next week.
So to find out which movie is Dave's favorite Bruce Willis movie,
Die Hard,
it is the movie you think it is. Come back next week and see what the rest of the list looks like. But until then,
yippee-ki-yay up.